getting lost.
Mm.
And
I think this, sorry, was
it? No, that's
the, talking about this building, the old Parliament House, I believe it has a certain significance in terms of the, was it the first general meeting of the...
Oh, yes. When they decommissioned this as a parliament, they were very uncertain about what to do with the building, and it was sort of almost mothballed. And I discovered that it was possible to arrange to book the chambers for special functions. Because I think the people were just sort of desperate to find a real use for it. It certainly wasn't the gallery and museum that it is now. And so we booked the Senate chamber for our annual general meeting and used King's Hall for the annual general meeting ball, and to which we invited parliamentarians and people from various lobby groups and public servants and everything like that. And we staged a our meeting in the Senate chamber. My president sat in the speaker's chair. One of my staff actually got a frilly necklace and a thing that looked like a black rod and knocked on the front door and to usher everyone into the chamber. And all these health insurance executives were sitting around on the red armchairs in the Senate, pretending to be, or feeling like they were senators. And everyone had a great time. It was terrific. I don't know whether they still allow that to be done. They certainly should. It puts a bit of life into the place.
When was that roughly?
Oh, that would have been... I can't remember the dates on which the houses actually changed. But it would have been 90s, I suppose, late 80s or 90s.
It was soon after the move up there.
Very soon after the move up there.
So that's very early in terms of the history of the building.
Ah, yes, within say, 12 months of the move. And they had not at that stage decided whether to make it a museum or or what. And I imagine they were having these sort of things just so it could still stay alive and not become derelict.
Yeah, well, that early post Parliament period is something of interest to us here. Do you remember what the condition was like of the building?
It was fundamentally in pretty good shape, actually. I don't think there'd been. I don't think they had made any changes. The chambers were both intact. The Senate chamber was exactly as it was the day before the Parliament, the location changed. And in fact, it was virtually identical to what it was when I was working for Withers, probably 10 years earlier. So, or more than 10 years earlier. So, as a building, at that time, it was in very good condition. I don't know how much access there was to the sort of back part of it, whether that was closed down or what. I think we had external caterers, so the kitchens weren't working. We had to get a caterer from outside to come and provide the dinner. But that was quite a gala occasion. We had big tables all around. Terrific.
And that was in King's Hall?
In King's Hall, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Roughly how many people do you think?
Oh, probably 200.
Okay.
It was a big night. And we had a jazz band.
Jazz. Yeah, okay.
14 piece big band.
Would you have any photos of that?
No, I don't, Barry. I'm afraid. No, I don't.
Yeah, well, that decade of, the 1990s, in terms of this building, it was it's a period that needs to be researched, I think. I've spoken with people who worked here in the late 90s and or mid to late 90s, and, the things weren't that good in the mid-90s.
I imagine it would have started to deteriorate. And, of course, the place... I vividly recall when I was in the bureau, we were constantly getting workmen in, usually electricians, plumbers and the like, and an electrician came in one day and he said, this whole bloody building's just held together by electrical wiring. He said, if we took the wiring out, the whole place would fall down. And of course, they were constantly replacing the phone lines, the power lines, everything.
And that was when you were in the gallery?
That was when I was in the gallery. So it was wearing out as a building. It needed very substantial reconditioning, even in those days. And that was in up till 83. So it was quite a few years before the change.
I was wondering about the skill set that you had as a journalist and editor and so on. How did that transfer to your role as a lobbyist, or did you require a completely new kind of...
No, I always saw myself as being in the information business. And as a lobbyist, as a journalist, you sort of take in information and then reproduce it in a newspaper or a television bulletin or a radio broadcast. As a lobbyist, I found it was basically a case of taking information from government and feeding it back out to my members, or taking information from my members and feeding that back into government. So it was really just, I saw the skill set as such as being quite compatible with either job. It was a case of just delving into find out what the facts were, and then you'd come up with analysing the facts to see what the real situation might be, and then present that to whichever audience might be appropriate at the time. And sometimes it'd be a case of advising my membership as to what the government was thinking, what it was likely to do, what it was planning to do, how that would affect them, and then feeding that back into government as to, you'll have a problem here. It was very, very much a two-way exchange of information. And a lot of the time we're able to save the government from, what do they call it, unforeseen consequences of legislation. I suppose people would have regarded me as being unduly assertive at times. I took the view that if you couldn't sell a case forcibly, there was not much point in... if you couldn't sell it unforcibly, you had to try and sell it forcibly, and did so. There were times when that would mean going very, very public and highlighting an issue in the public arena and forcing the government to make concessions. As often as not, one would try to provide some advance information to government that was going on, so that they didn't have a problem with the unexpected. And in there were two or three election campaigns where health policy was very, very influential, and we took very, very strong positions on it. And on three occasions, they were contrary to the position of the Labor Party, and we took some very, very, very strong public action in terms of encouraging our membership to either vote for the coalition, which was offering a better deal for health insurance, or against Labor. But I always made a point of letting the people within the Labor Party, particularly the campaign manager, who was usually the National Secretary, know precisely what we were doing in advance, and how we would do it, and what we would expect from them if they did certain things. We'd turn off the aggro. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. But we were able to maintain. By doing that, I found we were able to maintain a working relationship with both sides of politics, even though from time to time we would end up with a confrontation. And I think far too many people in the business community don't understand that. They don't understand that The lobbyist is a part of the overall political process. The industry association is part of it. And politicians expect industry associations to defend their members' interests. If you don't defend your members' interests, they regard you with contempt. They'll regard you with... They'll be angry if you do become vocal, but they'll respect you. Whereas if you don't vigorously defend what you're supposed to defend and advance the interests of your cause, as I said, they regard you with contempt. And that's both sides of politics. We had at one stage when the 30% rebate legislation was being was going through the parliament, Labor was opposing it, bitterly opposing it. And we arranged one day, I was able to bring together the private hospitals, the AMA, and ourselves to go and have a meeting with Kim Beazley, who was then the Labor leader. And we went in there, and Jenny Macklin was with Kim, and he didn't take her eyes off her. She was then the spokesman on health, and she was obviously influencing his behaviour. He, every time he said anything, he'd look at her for approval. And finally, he said, "Oh, we were getting nowhere," and he said, "We're still going to oppose this." And I said, "Well, you know, the problem is the industry's going to die if this legislation doesn't go through." And he said, "Well, that's tough." And he said, "You can threaten to take it out on us beforehand, but when we get back into power, we'll." Deal with you, we'll hate you. And I said, "Well, that may be so, Kim, but first of all, you've got to get into government, and if you're going to maintain this stance, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure you don't." And we parted. Then we actually shook hands and left. And after that, we letter-bombed, for want of a better word, a number of marginal seats with a letter that was signed by myself, the AMA president, the private hospitals, and the Association of Independent Retirees, warning them that, or urging them to contact their local Labor member and urge them to let the legislation go through. And finally, in a very, very round debate about circuitous route, I think that message did get through. And although Labor continued to to oppose it in the Senate, they didn't complain too much when both Mal Colston and Brian Harradine voted to allow it to go through.
So. I have another question. It's a fairly obvious one, but I want to ask it anyway for the record. You know, I'm assuming that you're, in addition to the skill set that we've talked about, the actual contacts in the journalistic area would have been very advantageous.
Oh, undoubtedly so, yes, yes. I mean, of course, I mean, you could do that sort of job and start from scratch and make those contacts. But it was useful to know editors and news editors and senior people in management in news organisations, as well as people in the gallery, and ministerial staff and members of parliament. And they knew me from the old days when I guess different relationships had been formed. I think they trusted me. I did have a pretty good record of not breaching confidences, and I think that flowed through into being a lobbyist. People would know that they could talk to you confidentially, and they might tell you something in that they didn't want people to know that they'd told you, and by that I meant departmental officials or politicians, they knew that they could be confident. I would never tell anyone what the source of my information was. And I think that was a very valuable tool. The communication skills, such as they might be, I think are also very useful. I mean, one of the things I did do was my telephone number was available to the world, and that's not quite true. My secretary's telephone number was known to the world. My mobile number was known only to me and her. My home number was known to them, and the journos knew that they could always contact me either at home, or if I wasn't in the office, my secretary would contact me and I'd ring them back from my mobile, and within minutes of the call, unless I was actually in a meeting or something like that. And that meant that I was able to influence the news cycle such as it was, and do a lot of radio. I mean, I've always believed, and still do, radio is probably the most influential medium that you can use. Low cost in terms of money, in terms of energy. Most radio talkback operators will give you a fair go in the health area. That most of them were fairly sympathetic to the industry. So being able to hit the airwaves I found very useful, because you were talking to not just to the people who the ordinary radio listeners, but of course one of the other things is using the government feedback machines, because the governments, all governments, monitor the media intensely, and if an issue is coming up on radio, it's not very long before that gets to the minister, and the minister then, or his staff, have to start thinking about how they're going to respond to it. So one could use access to a radio station to get a very, very quick message into government. In fact, if anything, I would tend to say now, governments would be better spending a lot less time monitoring the media and getting on with governing rather than what they do. And the 24-hour news cycle has made it even more difficult for them. But, yeah.
Now, Russell, how are you for time?
Oh, I think we're about right.
Okay. I did want to ask about the Order of Australia that you were awarded.
Yep.
Can you just tell us briefly about...
Well, I don't know how or why I got it, but I know I retired, and after I retired, I was... someone had put me in for the honour, and I still to this day do not know who it was. I can make a few guesses about people who may have supported it, but all that happened is one day I got a letter from the Governor-General advising me that this was in the offing, and could I confirm that I'd be prepared to accept it.
Mm.
And it was provided to me for services to the health insurance industry and to health policy generally, because I don't want to sound too boastful. I had played quite a significant part, I think, in developing policy as it applied to the health insurance industry, no doubt about that. But you couldn't isolate health insurance policy from public health policy generally. And so I was involved in quite a lot of discussions with ministers and departmental officials about public health policy as well, and how the two things interlinked, and how one could... could actually facilitate the more efficient working of the other, and in a two-way street. And I guess I can only conclude that that's the reason.
Yeah. And what's your current situation?
Oh, I'm currently on the board of the Hospitals Contribution Fund of Australia, which is the biggest not-for-profit health fund in Australia. And I went on to that shortly after I retired. They invited me on, and I was more than happy to accept. And about four years ago, the Minister for Health in New South Wales appointed me to the New South Wales Southern District Health Board, which runs public hospitals in southern New South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've maintained a very active interest in health and health policy all that time.
Very good.
And from time to time, try to write books.
yeah. Well, you did the Peacock.
War Without Blood and The Colt from Kooyong, and they were both a lot of fun. And now I'm looking at writing one on health policy, which I call The Medicare Conspiracy, and another one on Australian early history, and which is work of faction. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay. All right, well, again, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
An excellent interview. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry.